So I'm here today, Josephine Ensign. I'm here. It's my pleasure to be with Lois Thetford, and it is Thursday, July 2nd, 2015, and we're at the Jack Straw Studios. And Lois, as we were talking, this is an interview, oral history, about the Skid Road History Project, which is a project to increase the understanding of the complexity of charity health care in King County, Washington, and charity care being, you know, largely however you want to go with that. So the first question I have for you is, what led you to the work that you do?
So I moved to Seattle in 1970 with a large group of people from upstate New York. And some of the people in our group were involved in starting the Country Doctor Clinic, and I was involved with the Fremont Clinic, and we also worked with the Black Panthers, and we moved to Seattle because it was a fertile area for organizing, and there was sort of an advance guard of people that went to Baltimore and Chicago and L.A. and various places, and they said Seattle is the best place to do organizing. This is the time to be here. So 50 of us moved here that summer, including Tom Byers, who was a health aide to Rice, the mayor, and various other people. He was one of the early Country Doctor people. So I came here with an agenda of, you know, sort of looking at what kinds of services were needed, what kinds of activism was possible in this place. And so the 45th Street Clinic is a merger of two clinics. One is the Open Door Clinic, which opened in 69 and started out serving street youth in the University District. And the other branch is the Fremont Clinic, which opened in 71 and was organized around Fremont, but then moved to Greenwood and is now in Wallingford. And so our whole agenda was to address inequities, things that were sort of grievously wrong. So naturally, the war in Vietnam was a big focus for a lot of people in the milieu that we were working with. And so resistors, I worked for a year and a half or 2 years really in Tacoma, also with the Shelter Have Coffee House, which organized people and assisted people who were refusing to go to Vietnam or refusing to serve. So conscientious objectors. And we got lawyers and we did organizing among Black enlisted people. There was a Black Airmen's Association at the McCord Air Base then. We worked with them. We did welfare rights organizing. We ran a bookstore and a movie program and worked with veterans and sort of had a wide variety of things, daycare organizing. So I moved to this area with a view of sort of looking at what is going on in our society and what ways can we change what's happening. So when we first started the Fremont Clinic, there was very limited charity care. There was a place called Doctors Hospital, which was absorbed by Swedish later, that actually did a lot of charity care. Like we could refer people there who needed minor surgeries and things like that. And we started the clinic serving many different people, lots of young people, but older people as well. And we worked with some of the senior centers, the Greenwood Senior Center specifically. I would go there regularly and do foot care and outreach things. And we had some paid docs and some volunteer docs. And we were also organizing ourselves to become healthcare workers. And so we did sort of on-the-job training, and then people went off and became nurse practitioners, physicians, physician assistants, all kinds of things. And so it was a very dynamic time. It was a very dynamic place to be here in Seattle. And there were lots and lots of people living in very unsuitable housing or unstable housing. There were like something like two-thirds of the former Boeing employees were unemployed at that time. And so there was a place in Fremont called the Georgetown Free Store. And if you needed a refrigerator or you needed a bed or a couch, you could go to the Free Store and say, you know, I'm an unemployed person. I need this. And so we moved here in mail trucks that we bought at $100 at auction and outfitted them as campers and drove across the country. And so once we were here, we used our trucks and we moved things for the Free Store and we moved things for the Panthers Breakfast for Children program or other kinds of, you know, sort of anybody that needed a truck, we would move things for them in our mail trucks. And so both the branches of what became 45th Street Clinic, the open door clinic, which was at 50th and Roosevelt here in the U District, and the Fremont Clinic, which actually opened in the Fremont Baptist Church in Fremont, served large groups of people who were not housed in standard, suitable, stable housing. So all of my early healthcare work was around sort of underserved populations and underhoused populations. And then we moved to our clinic in Greenwood for the Fremont Clinic, and Open Door eventually moved to a little house on 45th that's just in the same block where the 45th Street Clinic is now. And our populations changed somewhat, but during the early 80s, we did outreach to the sanctuary churches. And so being bilingual, Spanish, English, I started working a lot with homeless populations that were refugees. And when we started our homeless programs through the Robert Wood Johnson initial grants in 1985, we had a nurse practitioner who started in that position, Joanne Tilton, and a social worker, and we had, you know, a variety of support services. But our outreach to the sanctuary churches immediately swelled our Hispanic population. And even today, they are a third of our 45th Street population are Spanish-speaking only. So that became a really big part of what the clinic did. Our homeless populations tended to be primarily English-speaking. We had a variety of different kinds of outreach. So we would go to, say, the food bank of the Fremont Public Association. We would go and serve the shelters, the mobile homes around 130th and Aurora, and the motels along Aurora. We had a lot of – there were a couple of them that were specifically primarily homeless or homeless families, and we would serve them. And then we also added in the early 90s a lot of pediatric outreach. One of the things about the early homeless programs were that they were oriented towards adults. And family homelessness was not recognized as being such a big part of it. But we started a homeless daycare program, an outreach to that program, that was at Sacred Heart on Queen Anne, by the Sacred Heart Church, which is where their family shelter still is. And then they moved to a space at the Seattle Children's Home, and then they moved to a space down at Weller and 20th. And so for many years, I provided direct outreach to those sites. And then we started also going into public schools. So there was a program within the Seattle Public Schools that included 5 elementary schools, a high school, and a middle school that had on-site staff and support services for homeless youth. And so I serviced many of those sites, and they ran a summer program, and I went to their summer program and provided on-site medical services to those ones as well. And so I picked up – so Joanne Tilton did it for a year, and then Diane Walker was our homeless nurse, and then I took over from Diane. And so for about 25 years, I primarily went to battered women shelters, public schools with large concentrations of homeless children, homeless daycare center, and whatever other kinds of outreach stuff was really needed, and coordinated with our programs as they grew. So that was our family homeless program. And so we went to the Catherine Booth shelter, the Broadview shelter, the Sacred Heart family shelter, the Union Gospel family shelter, not all at the same time, but sort of serially as different programs developed. And so I went to the Whittier School, the BF Day School, the summer program at Bailey Gatzert and at Van Asselt, and served on a lot of sort of committees that worked with homeless children and homeless families and their interaction with the school system, and to try to first place school, and also neighborhood health. What is it? The neighborhood house.
Oh, neighborhood house, right? Yes.
Which had a daycare that primarily served homeless kids from the Seattle Housing Authority nexus right there in where they are and have been, but are probably moving with the new
down
Yesler.
Down near Yesler, right.
Yeah, by Yesler. And so so Head Start programs as well. So I just sort of worked with all those things, but I also had at the clinic a walk-in day, and lots of adult homeless people would come in for walk-in day. And that was, I felt, a really good thing to have just walk-in, and we would just advertise it and so on. And you know, as clinic operations shifted and the community health centers became much more mainstream, and there was this major focus on having all the providers be fully licensed and, you know, everything being up to snuff. Some of the more casual aspects of our homeless program got more codified, and walk-in day was one of those things that went by the wayside because it wasn't efficient. It's much better to have everyone be scheduled, blah, blah, blah. But as we know, homeless populations need walk-in times.
Low access.
Low barrier access. Right.
Right.
So as many of the earlier programs that we worked with changed or stopped receiving our services. For example, we had a real issue with Union Gospel Mission because I went to both their emergency and their traditional housing units. They felt that we were providing too many services, that having access to direct medical care in their shelter for people that were just coming out of being in jail for 3 to 5 years or, you know, immigrant moms that were in domestic violence situations was just too cushy for them, and they felt it made their clients lazy to have direct access to care. They stopped having both our enrollment in Medicare services on site, our counseling on site, and our medical services on site because they didn't feel that it was forcing their clients to be as self-reliant as they thought they should be.
And that was about around when
was that? That was when I started going to the Landing, which was about 4 years before I started before I became youth clinic lead, which was about 10 years ago or so, or not quite, because maybe it was like 07 that I think I became youth clinic lead. So like around 2000, there was we sort of shifted and some of our services changed. And so I started doing more adolescent outreach and more direct medical care to adolescents. Being less involved with some of the domestic violence and family shelters. And I really, really liked working with the adolescents, like I really, really liked working with all the other populations. And so it had to do with the fact that services from the East Side Public Health Department were on a contract basis, and they sort of ran for 6 months, and then they didn't have anyone for like 9 months, and then they got somebody again, and it was very inconsistent what their funding was. So I had that time available, and so Lori Becker from Healthcare for the Homeless said, well, we really like somebody to cover the landing. Would you do that? And I was like, of course, I'd be happy to do that. I had worked with our youth clinic really from the beginning because I would cover for people who were off, like so Phyllis Holsworth was our first nurse practitioner for youth clinic, and when we expanded to two nights a week, she really couldn't do that. And so for like the first 3 months, I did that second night, and there was a hope that it would work out with her schedule and her family that she could do that, but it didn't. So she left, and then Erin Mahan came in, but Erin was also teaching at Seattle U Nursing School, and so she was in Central America for a couple of months with a group of students, and then she got amoebic dysentery. and so I actually covered for her for about 5 months in that year that she was doing that. And she would come in during the day and do the follow-up stuff, but I would just do the clinic stuff. And then I also worked with some of our school clinics, particularly for Helen Weems, our nurse practitioner there. She had a leave, and then she had two kids and had a maternity leave. So a couple of different years I worked there and really connected with a lot of the homeless teens that were at Roosevelt. One of them was this girl whose mom lived in disabled housing, and she was her only parent, and she didn't have other family. And living in disabled housing, her mom could only have a guest 10 nights per month. So the 1st through the 10th, she would stay with her mom, and the rest of the month, she was homeless. And she would come into the clinic, and she was very depressed and very sad because she didn't want to be homeless. She wanted to live with her mom, but she couldn't. And there were a lot of sort of youth like that that would sort of come to the clinic and was like, I don't know where I'm going to be tonight. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to get food. So it was like there's so many different avenues for where you meet homeless people. They come to the clinic. They're at the shelter. They're not at the shelter. They're at walk-in. They're at the food bank. They're at school. Yeah. They're everywhere. So, you know, over time, I really began to focus more and more on, okay, where are the avenues, you know, that we can pull people in and where can we get them more services? And, you know, and youth clinic was designed so well, you know, the 45th Street Homeless Youth Clinic, because it provided such a range of services. You know, the addition of dental was, you know, just brilliant.
That's huge. Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. So needed. And you know, having both counseling and substance abuse and meditation and yoga and things like that that they could use to calm themselves, you know, to get through stressful situations. So,
right, it was things that the young people actually asked for.
Yes,
and the people at the clinic listened.
yes.
for it to.
Yes, right, that it was such a receptive environment.
Right.
And, you know, initially the lead person did not have a role or job title or pay commensurate with what was really needed there. And so we, you know, eventually we were able to elevate that position to, you know, this requires a master's in social work and this is the kind of – these are the reasons why that's the appropriate thing. And their title as, you know, youth clinic lead became more than just calling volunteers and
right.
and having a much more structured and an acknowledgement of how important that role was. Those were really important improvements that happened before we joined NeighborCare, so that some of those things were carried over and that appropriate case management, say for pregnant teens,
mm-hmm.
was acknowledged as this is a kind of service that's absolutely essential for doing the right kind of service for this population. And this is why, you know, we need to prioritize making this clinic be as full and rounded as it is.
That was me. I'm sorry. I just turned it off. Yeah. I usually turn that off. So it was a little ping.
And, mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're just checking on that. So I want to go back just a little bit. I love the mail trucks with the caravan across the country. And you're a physician assistant.
I am now.
Just to clarify that for people.
Right.
But when did you get that? Because, I mean, obviously a lot of this mm-hmm. health-related work is
right.
in your capacity as a PA, as a physician assistant.
Right. So when we started forming all the clinics, the community health system here in Seattle, most of the people who were involved in starting the clinics were not licensed. There were some nurses, there were some volunteer physicians, but for the most part, we were organizers and we were people who cared about people and access to services. But gradually there was a move towards getting more license. And at the Fremont Clinic, it particularly came in 1978. The person who was the head of the Department of Licensing at that time was a black woman named Roz Woodhouse. And she heard what we were doing, particularly our midwifery program that we ran out of Fremont, and said, you know, the penalty for practicing without a license is, you know, as much as a $10,000 fine and a year in jail. And that was, you know, in 1978 when money was worth different than it is now. But she said, that's not our goal for you. We don't want to prosecute you. We would like to see you all get licensed. And so two things happened out of that. A lot of us went to – so one of our practitioners who's unlicensed. She had worked with the Santa Cruz Women's Clinic, and we had a couple people in our clinic who'd been in Berkeley or Santa mm-hmm. Cruz or wherever. And so she went to the Yale program and became a nurse practitioner, and her name was Nancy Lim. And then we had one person who was trained at in the PA program at Harbor in LA and was a women's healthcare specialist. And then we had some docs that worked with us and numerous people from the original organizing of Country Doctor and Fremont and the other clinics. And in those days, we all worked together. We were all – like all of the women from the different community health centers worked together and did training together and Eschenbach from Harborview sort of ran a little course for us one summer where we all learned about all of the STD research that was going on, you know, before there was the Center for Excellence in STD stuff. You know, that was still – that was all happening then.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would meet regularly and we would share our resources and share our experience and help one another because we were all on the same side. We were not competing against one another. And So it didn't matter which clinic you worked at. But so a lot of us went either into PA school or nursing school or nurse practitioner school. So I got into the PA program in 1980. I applied in 78, 79, and 80, and I finally got in 1980. And they felt that I was way too non-traditional, you know, because most of their applicants were medical corpsmen who had extensive medical experience. And the other thing was that they felt that, you know, you could only really do good medicine if you saw men. And the fact that all my experience was with women and children somehow didn't quite match, you know, what medicine was supposed to be at that time. But I did manage to get in, and they are really happy that they let me in.
Right, and now you teach there,
and you know, I have been awarded many awards by the MedEx program in humanitarian care, and I was awarded the Jefferson Award for Public Service in 2000,
right.
And you know, I've been one of their star pupils.
You can say I told you so. Right?
Well, it shows the big shift in medicine because, of course, in those days, all research was done in men, nothing in women. Women weren't important to medicine in the 60s and 70s and finally became legitimate.
Right.
Patients, more, so. As things progressed.
Especially with you know, humanitarian awards and different things like that. But what would you say is your biggest joy, like the biggest highlight of your work?
Well, the thing that I love about patient care and that I especially love about homeless care is that you can make such a difference. You meet people when they are in a very bad place in their lives, and by treating them what I think of as appropriately, which is respectfully and hearing them out, letting them tell you who they are and what their needs are, you get to participate. You become a witness to their life journey, and that is an honor. And to gain their trust is the most important thing to do to help them, because most people who are homeless have been treated badly, not just by the medical system, but in many situations. And they're not used to being treated with respect, and they're very suspicious of you. And in order to just treat them properly, you have to be able to bridge that gap and not say to this person, you know, I don't respect you. Like, I had one of my homeless clients who had rheumatoid arthritis. She was a family homeless, kind of typical, divorced. They lost the home. The home was sold, and they didn't have resources, and they became homeless. And they lived in a motel, and, you know, they had a pretty common homeless track for families. A couple of kids, her mother lived with them because she had disabilities with this rheumatoid arthritis that she'd gotten really young. And had, you know, hip dysplasia and various things. And so she was not getting treatment. You know, she hadn't been diagnosed with her rheumatoid arthritis. So we did the labs, you know, on an outpatient basis in her motel room. But I really wanted a consult. So I sent her to this rheumatologist, and she came back and she said, I will never see that person again. He said to me, I don't approve of your lifestyle. Assuming she was a drug addict, of course, because she was homeless. But, you know, this is how I will help you. She was a particularly complicated case because she only had one kidney, and many of the rheumatoid drugs are hard on your kidneys. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like it was appropriate to get that. But that's what they meet. People assume that they are lowlife, that they're losers, that they don't deserve the kind of care that housed people deserve. And so, you know, that was just one of those many little things that happens that's like so hard to get the appropriate care for people who really need it. And all you have to do is be a person, you know, just see them as a regular person and come across with that. You know, I care about you. I care that you live. And they don't hear that. And they don't have that sense that their lives are important to anyone. You know, like one of my homeless moms, it's one of my favorite cases. I first started seeing her son because he was at the homeless daycare. They were homeless. They were housed. They were homeless. And she was at a large shelter. And we picked her up when the Pathways Home thing started, but I had already knew her son from before. And the daycare staff said, you know, he's a problem because he's kind of aggressive. And what it turned out was that he was anemic. He had chronic ear infections, and his hearing and speech were delayed because of his health conditions, not because he had a behavior problem. But he was somewhat aggressive, which is what young children do when they don't have language. They push, and it works for them. And so we worked with her for a long time. And so first she was in the shelter, then she got housing at Rainier Vista, and they were pretty stabilized. And then they tore down Rainier Vista, just like they're doing with the Yesler Terrace mm-hmm. now in Holly Park, and replacing it with mixed use, fewer home, low-income people, and so on. But at that juncture, she was seeing me at the clinic. And she brought with her the father of her child's father. They had been together when the baby was young, but he just opted out and hadn't been involved with his son pretty much at all. So by this time, the boy is like 4.5 or 5. And the grandfather comes, and she's a minority and he's white. And she has chronic hepatitis B, so she has a lot of health issues of her own. But we had gotten the little guy, you know, not anemic, fixed the chronic ear problems, did, you know, caught up with his speech, so on, you know, with this coordinated effort between the homeless daycare and providing appropriate services and giving mom support and getting them housed through Pathways Home and so on. And so the grandfather says to me, I think my son is a jerk for not having any interest in his boy, but I am willing to do that. I'm willing to take him to Boy Scouts and do all these things with him, but I live in Issaquah, and I can't just come to Seattle all the time. So if she would move to the east side, I would do this. And he said, but I don't really understand her. I don't know her. It seems to me that she's very lazy. So I said, she's not lazy. She's sick. And so he didn't know anything about chronic hepatitis B. And he didn't know how that was affecting her housekeeping or her parenting or whatever. And a lot of people had criticisms of her parenting because she let him watch Dragon Ball Z, which the daycare felt was way too violent and that was why he had this behavior problem. And, you know, so there was like a lot of mediating to do. So one of the great things about being a healthcare for the homeless provider is that not only do you work directly with the client, but you have to be an advocate for them. So I gave that rheumatologist a piece of my mind about his assumptions about homeless people. And I said to this dad, you know, grandpa, she's not lazy. She's doing everything she can. She just has a very limited amount of energy because she is sick. And that's what you need to see here is, not that she's not a good parent or not good at housekeeping. You need to see that she's doing everything she can. So he said, okay, I didn't know any of that. And so they moved to the east side. He did that, what he said he would do. Our boy is now like 16 or 17 and doing really well. And he needed advocacy. He needed advocacy at the daycare. He needed advocacy for his mom. He needed advocacy in his family. He needed medical and social support. And he has thrived. He is nice. Just doing great. And, you know, that's what you want to see.
Right. So that's a a wonderful highlight to, and to be in this long enough that you actually see
right.
where he where
yeah, even though I haven't been in clinic, you know, for 10 years at 45th, I still have maintained contact with them just, you know, to sort of see how they're doing and because of sort of other kinds of advocacy things and just because it was just such a great coming together of the kinds of resources that we need
right.
to make this job a success.
Where's Is that where the echo is coming from? There's an echo. The echo will go away. Yeah? Okay. Sorry. You just wanted me to, yeah. So it's a lovely highlight, which I can imagine, and knowing you a bit, is worth many, many humanitarian awards, right? But so how do you relate it to that? How do you keep from burning out?
Well, one of the things that we did in our homeless program at 45th is that we had a meeting every month on secondary trauma. And especially when you're working with domestic violence and all our clients get beat up all the time, you absorb that. And so we really worked on doing the secondary trauma. So for many years, we had excellent leadership in the homeless programs, and they looked out for us, and they did good things for us, and they supported us as workers. They did not just expect us to produce more and more. They said, step back, take a day, take what you need. They were very supportive. That made a big difference. And recognizing and understanding what secondary trauma is, it's very important to do this work.
All right. So for you, knowing that for yourself, but then also when you could of working in a supportive environment mm-hmm. that knew what that was about and
yes.
and took care of its employees
right.
as well. Right.
Yes. Yeah, that was really important for being able to do that, to feel like your boss had your back.
And you're speaking about that in past tense, Lois.
Yes, I am.
and you've mentioned a few little things about having to work faster, producing things like that. But mm-hmm. So that's related to another question I have. Is just like what do you feel like we need in our kind of supportive charity care, supportive services in King County mm-hmm. To improve things to go forward?
Well, it's really important to have coordination. It's really important to have social work and counseling be part of the program, be supported to do this work, and to have case consultations. I think that is so valuable. I had a mom at Broadview who had mental health issues, some serious mental health issues, and she had a premature baby. And her issues really affected how she parented her baby. And so we had a case conference meeting. So there was the Broadview staff that work with her. There was her mental health person, her substance abuse person. I was there. And I think there was a public health nurse that had been involved with the baby as well. And it was such a good thing to give people time, you know, because it takes time to do that kind of coordination, to allow in your provider schedule time to work with the other disciplines and pull those resources together and actually talk about what's happening. So this is what I see from my perspective, and this is what I see from my perspective, and just really giving people the resources to do the job that's needed.
And so you see that has eroded, has gone away to some extent?
Yes. So since 45th Street and the Youth Clinic are part of a very large network, that has much more of a corporate administrative structure. It's not as people-oriented. It's much more numbers-oriented. And it's all about, I mean, like the regular providers in the clinic who are doing, you know, at least half, sometimes 60% of their visits in another language with people who don't have resources, they're expected to see 28 patients a day. And that's not reasonable to provide this kind of care. And you can't do a lot about walk-in. So you can't schedule 4 patients per hour when you're doing walk-in because you can't schedule them. You know, the whole emphasis on expansion has thinned out what the services are that are available to clients and to providers. And that is a bad thing.
Okay. Yes, it is a bad thing. And one other question kind of looping back that I was interested in, if you could expand upon. And this is I think it was back more in the late 70s, early 80s, if I'm getting your chronology, when you were all of you were just doing this work,
right,
for what was needed. And you mentioned that at that time Doctors Hospital would take some charity care. But
right,
what was going on back then and that you saw in terms of Harborview?
Okay. So Harborview has always been a good resource. And a lot of our clients get the only specialty care that they can get from Harborview. And they have been really part of the resource network, especially in specialties. For example, young women with cervical abnormalities, you know, we could send them to Harborview and they would take care of them. And that was really important. Or we had a homeless client who was homeless because she was young. She had breast cancer. She was a couch surfer. And, you know, they did take care of her medical needs. And they weren't able to address some of her larger needs. But she got the medical care that she needed. And that has always been sort of where Harborview fits, is that they are a resource that have things that nobody else has, you know. I do have to say that back when they had dental at Harborview, emergency dental at Harborview was an invaluable service. And the fact that they stopped providing dental at Harborview, I think, is something they should reconsider still to this day.
That's a huge need.
It was one of those resources that there just isn't, you know. Other things. Residents who worked at the different residency programs around the county were also a really important resource for clinics because they would, you know, help us with trainings or do volunteering or whatever. And it was very, very valuable. And I have to say that the whole STD program from King Holmes and Eschenbach, just from the beginning, that they have provided resources to us that have been invaluable. You know, just the testing, the treatment, you know, that we can provide the treatment free of charge has been such a valuable resource. Part of that now is handled by the public health, but, you know, but forever they've been the leaders, and they have made a huge difference in public health in this county and in this whole area. I mean, we have people who come to us from Arlington, and they say, I can't get any specialty care. I can't get the referral that I need for dermatology or rheumatology or whatever it is, and they would come to our clinic in Seattle and they would see us so that they could go to Harborview.
So it's kind of just an entry door.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. Because they didn't have any other access.
Right.
And, you know, the system keeps changing and it's so much bigger now and there's a lot more resources in Everett now than there were for a really long time. But we have people from everywhere that come. We had people who came to us from Stehekin because there were no clinics that they could easily get to.
Right.
She had a thyroid condition and I said, I really need you to at least go to Chelan and get a blood draw. She said, I don't have the resources to do that. I can't afford that. I can only – she would get to Chelan and get to Seattle. And that was less expensive for her
than getting something there. So hopefully with ACA expansion,
right,
that she's getting something closer by.
Yeah, and she really needs it,
right.
You know, because that's too far to come for your health care. But Harborview has been sort of the leader in being a regional resource. And, you know, now they try to just serve King County, which is, you know, a mere 2.3 million people, mm-hmm. twice the size of Rhode Island. So even in King County, they can still come from very far away to get services that may not be available to them closer.
Right.
So that's really where Harborview is fit. And then the other thing is the Pioneer Square Clinic that Harborview recognized really early that they needed an outpost that served people that otherwise would be flooding their hospital. And so starting the Pioneer Square Clinic, and it's really interesting because when we started the Healthcare for the Homeless program, the people that worked at the community health centers were on a different kind of contract, and the people who worked at Pioneer Square and downtown who were headed at Harborview had a different kind of contract, a different pay scale, different resources, better benefits. Harborview really did work on making resources for the homeless population, and particularly having a comprehensive program with the social services, like Ken Crable, who's, you know, sort of a national leader, mm-hmm. With homeless care, was the lead for the mental health aspect of the Harborview homeless program. And, you know, created resources, trained so many people in how to do this work as a behavioral health person, with what we call it now.
And trauma-informed care.
Trauma-informed care. And, you know, motivational interviewing and just all kinds of things. That their investment early on has benefited the whole country, not just the region, not just King County, everyone. So that is one of the great things about having a research institution, is that they invest in creating things that then become the standard, you know, like the STD stuff. You know, people, when I went, you know, I've been through the STD course, you know, every 10 or 15 years or so, just to be updated. You know, and people come from all over the world. It's not just us. It's, you know, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. So that investment has global reach.
Yeah, that is huge. So the last one, anything that I haven't asked you about that you wanted to
Well, I wanted to talk about another youth example.
Okay.
So one day Charlotte and I were in the office and we got a call. Anyone from youth clinic, please come downstairs. So Charlotte was like, I'm not expecting anyone. I'll just go down and see. And so this young woman came and she said, you don't know me, but 10 years ago I was homeless and I was at the worst place in my life. I was really sick. I didn't I wasn't coping well, and I just didn't know what to do. And I came here, and you took care of me, and you treated me well. And I just want you to know that that was the thing that turned my life around. And now I'm married. I've graduated from college. My husband and I have a son. We're buying our home. It started here for me. I don't have anything to give you but my story.
Right.
Just being there.
Yeah, and as a team. I mean, the whole clinic working together for that.
Right.
That is beautiful.
Yeah.
Right. Being able to hear those stories.
And it takes a really long time.
Yes.
So, you know, it had been 10 years for her. And for my little guy that I saw in daycare, it's been, you know, longer than that. But it's, you have to have tenacity. You have to believe in what you do. You have to fight your administration for the resources that you need. And you have to leave places that stop supporting you.
That's good wisdom to pass on. Yes, we've both been there and done that, right?
Right.
Yes. So thank you so much for taking time today. It's, as I said, it's an honor to sit across the table and talk with you after all those evenings in the clinic together.
That's right.
So thanks, Lois.
The good old days.
Yes, the good old days. Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.